We're checking in with State Representative Tacky Chan for another Tacky Talk. Hey, Tacky, nice to see you.
Great to see you, Joe. Happy Friday. It seems like Friday is our day.
Yeah, and happy October now. We're into a new month.
I know. It seems only yesterday that we're told to not leave the house. Now we're not leaving the house because it's legitimately getting cold.
Speaking of the House is not yet back in person session, right?
We are not. We're still waiting for a schedule. We've been informed by the House Ways and Means Chair that we're breaking down to smaller caucuses, about 20-ish members, to engage in conversation about the upcoming fiscal year 21 budget. Given the lack of movement by Congress, there is growing need for us to do something soon on a permanent budget for 2021. Unfortunately, the audience would not like to hear this, but when it comes to budget cuts, it's better doing it sooner in a fiscal year than it is later in a fiscal year. So everybody knows how to plan for the next 6 to 9 months of their budget versus trying to make them do massive cuts in the last 3 months of a budget.
Yeah.
So hard decisions are going to be coming, and a lot of the local funding that people gotten used to do the last decade because of a good economy may not happen anymore. You may not get those targeted earmarks coming up. You may not see, or you probably will not see, a special assistance, one-time assistance that we've done a lot of in Quincy. So we're going to be focusing on big-ticket items regarding large agencies. In my case, obviously agencies I oversee at the committees, the ABCC, Division of Professional Legislature, Consumer Affairs, and a few others, and trying to figure out where they fit in the COVID world. We're talking about investigation issues and the crucial jobs they do, and to try to preserve funding to continue the important work you do normally. But on top of that, the COVID work they're doing on compliance as well. So I'll be talking to the state agencies very shortly about this stuff and going to advocate for obviously agencies overseas, as well as any specific large big picture items that have an interest to the city.
Which would be what? Public transportation, public safety, infrastructure, things like that?
Yeah, but also things like English classes, for example. We're a big non-English speaking city, so you know English classes are very important. The continuation of things like school breakfast programs. This is another city that has a large school breakfast population, particularly in my district. There are a lot of folks who cannot afford a school breakfast, so those programs continue to be very important. We passed breakfast by the bell, they went to the governor. However, we still have to fund those programs. So you know, we talk about a lot of like big ticket items in the sense that you know, mass health, which is obviously very important to a population where probably one third of the city uses mass health in one form or another. You know, things like that that continue to be a priority, as well as things like local aid and Chapter 70 funding. But also in addition to that, these specific programs that help you know, my constituency directly, you know, has enormous value.
Yeah, I saw our estimates of deficits of upwards of $700 million. Does that sound accurate?
For a deficit?
Yeah.
No,
not for the city, but for the state.
Oh, with the city. The city, the city gets about, just from local aid, about, give or take, about just under $50 million. So you got about a 375-plus-ish budget for the city in that zone. So we're a significant contributor for that. But what isn't counted in that is things like money provided for Thomas Green Library. Mm-hmm. Money, all the different programs for schools, ranging from, like I said earlier, school breakfast to immunizations. You know, funding obviously for the MBTA is not part of the calculation for what the city receives directly in state assistance. And you got the bond monies, you know, things that we're using to pay for the seawall, things people seeing on road construction on C Street and Queen Shore Drive, the intersection intersection work there. Everything we try to put in DCR, you know, all the maintenance, you know, keeping the beach open. And obviously when there's bad weather events, you know, Mass Highway and DCR are out there trying to keep the roads clear during the wintertime and secure the area when there's a bad storm that comes through. So those are not direct money that actually goes to the city of Quincy, but it impacts our lives every day. So there's a lot of budgetary issues in the tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars via state agency providing services as part of the city, being in the city, or money that goes to a city program or a state program that our constituency receives benefits from.
But statewide, has there been any estimate as to what the deficit may be right now?
About 6 billion is still the number we're floating around.
Six billion with a B?
Yeah, 6 billion. I mean, our total tax revenue is about probably was projected around 36-ish, 37-ish billion dollars. So this is lost state tax revenue. So when you look at it that way, that's a lot of tax revenue to lose 6 billion of that. The overall budget is approximately 48 billion. But I remind folks, one third of our budget is federal reimbursements. So 50% is paid by the state on mass health. I mean, by the, you know, the state, yeah, pays 50% mass health. The federal government pays 50% mass health. Mm-hmm. Then we also get things like FEMA money. We get Homeland Security Assistance money for things like the airport. So, and they got federal programs for things like unemployment benefits, which is what we're doing a lot now. And we also get money for things like food stamps. That's a federal program that we administer. So that's actually part of our state budget. So when people look at, oh, you got a lot of money. Yeah, but not, it's not all our money. You know, a big chunk of that dough, about a third of it, actually comes from federal government, which we cannot play around with. That money is dedicated to federal programs the state administers. And what we got left is the tax money at about $36, $37 billion. That was the projection. And then we get fees and licensing fees, which the state has delayed. So we're not collecting fees till now. Actually, if you're a person in a professional licensor, your license fee actually is now going to be starting to be, need to be paid today that we delayed since the beginning of COVID.
Yeah.
So, you know, those fees that we have been getting, I mean, R&B fees were delayed because of COVID for months. You know, getting registration fees were delayed for months. So, yeah, I mean, you got that stuff. And of course, the park systems haven't been heavily utilized. So we lose fee money on the DCR and park system. I'm aging myself because I was about to say DEM. but the OWMDC and DEM was merged into DCR. But the passive parks, you know, you have the ability to rent a campground, for example, from the state.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff was postponed because of COVID.
Yep. We saw
a little money here and there, like $20, $30. But if you have a high rotation, it adds up.
Sure. The as you know, the governor recently allowed kind of step two of phase three opening in some of the lower risk communities, including Quincy. What do you think about that?
Well, it's a very cautious approach. I mean, I think a lot of us at the beginning of this process thought a phase meant a phase. You know, as we implemented phase two, it became clear to me this was phase two, part one, part two, part three. I'm not surprised we did the same thing with phase three. And he's relying heavily on medical data to do that. One of the challenges I think people have noticed on the red, green, yellow display is that it's based on an average of time. So we've been using the 7-day average positive response rate. We're looking at hospitalizations. You see that in the news every evening. All the local channels carry that, as well as our websites. But also, when it comes to opening up, you know, you're looking at the 7-day average of that community specifically. One of the challenges, of course, is that we're not an isolated community. We're also not a community that are like in the Midwest, where you have to drive 60 miles between the town. There's not that big gap of empty space. We're all tightly packed communities. The whole Northeast, reflection of the old colonial era, right? All your municipal borders are basically touching each other. So even though you know, your community may have a very low risk rate on the 7-day average or the 2-week average, depending on what number you're looking at, you have to be mindful that you're still next to a community that has a high average, which means, you know, obviously, we're not policing our borders. We do not have Quincy police checking you coming over the bridge. There is that transmission rate. So if you go into a higher risk area, the odds are you become more vulnerable to the possibility of infection coming back home, which can shift the numbers around. And that's kind of part of the complexity of Massachusetts compared to some other places where you could just close the city off. We don't have that option.
Yeah. Obviously, restaurants are extremely worried now with the colder weather coming. Outdoor dining is, you know, is going to be limited no matter how long they extend it. And whether or not people will participate in that is left to be seen. You think the state's doing all it can to help restaurants?
Well, we're running out of tools in many ways. You know, the restaurant recovery bill, so-called, is still languishing in the Senate Ways and Means Committee, as well as another version sitting in the Economic Development Bill, which is also known as conference committee. Now, obviously the winter time's gonna be over. There was limited things we could do because we can't stop nature. But things like sales tax deferment, again, affecting the state budget. We wanna defer sales taxes, meals taxes for cities and towns, I'm saying not city and towns, for the restaurants to pay the state. But don't forget, folks, 2.75% of your meals tax goes to the city and town. So I do not know if municipalities are going to be looking at deferring that 0.75% themselves at municipal level to try to help out on deferring payment to the city and towns of that. I'm going to tell you probably no. I have not heard one municipality willing to defer their 0.75% of the meals tax. Or at least asking the state, given the capacity to defer that 0.75% to a collective later date. We did talk to the Restaurant Association over the last couple of weeks. So far, as of a week ago, 3,400 out of 16,000 members of the Restaurant Association has gone out of business. 3,400 out of 16,000. And right now, my office is collecting data on return liquor licenses, meaning that restaurants who are no longer staying in business has to revert their liquor licenses back to the CN town. And while not all restaurants have liquor licenses, it gives us a bit of an indicator of what the restaurant industry is going. We do recognize that small communities have less liquor licenses, but it's not a precise number. We're just looking for a general ballpark of where things are. And certain businesses will be better situated because the 80% takeout, for example, versus ones that are not. And I suspect a lot of smaller businesses that can do takeout well will be completely restructuring the business for takeout in the winter. So, for example, in Holyoke, one of the statistics we got was about 60% of all liquor licenses in Holyoke have been reverted back to the town. Hmm. Wow. That's a lot of liquor licenses for even though it's a smaller community. Boston's floating at 10%. I suspect that's going to be well into 20-25% as we head into November.
Sure.
The Western Association also informs us that a survey of the zone membership, when they're inquiring about what the thoughts are, 40% of their membership states that if there's no change in COVID behavior, in or vaccine or anything else, they could be closed in 6 months. And then you have 46% of the Restaurant Association stating that if they don't get federal assistance in terms of some kind of bailout or PPP, they will be gone probably by year's end, and it's 46%.
Yeah.
So when they say dire, it's very much an understatement how dire the restaurant industry is right now.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I know, you know, unemployment claims are down from what they were, but they're still at record highs, both here in the state and across the country as well.
We're going to see a spike in October. The U.S. Census hired 280,000 plus people during the months of July, August, and into September. So as those temporary workers come off the census work, they'll be back on unemployment. So you should be seeing a spike coming up nationally as well as locally on that. And as PPP continues to run out, you know, they're going to be no longer on furlough and moved on to unemployment permanently. So the airline industry worldwide employs about 46 million people globally. The U.S. domestic airline industry employs about $10 million people. You have that 10 million people, you have that ripple effect, right? Every person loses a job means one less consumer spending money, you know, at a higher level in our consumer-based economy. Mm-hmm. And industry shutting down has a ripple effect on everything from fuel to food to clothing to dry cleaning and the whole gambit of that business. So if the feds don't provide another major bailout, let's just call it what it is, a bailout to the airline industry, you know, you're going to have 10 million. They're already doing layoffs now, permanent layoffs. You're going to have 10 million individuals on unemployment rules, not on PPP, basically government bailout payroll is what it is. And they're going to be sitting on our unemployment payroll, unemployment benefits, 10 million of them nationally.
Yeah, for folks who don't know, PPP, the Payroll Protection Plan or program, right?
Yeah, it's basically this government's paying you to keep your employees paid so they don't end up in unemployment. That's just the bottom line.
Yep.
And as long as you are able to pay them on the average what you paid them 1 year prior, and that you use the money that can demonstrate you're keeping your business open and keeping people off of unemployment, you get the money. So basically it's government paid salaries while you can't open during COVID.
Sure.
I mean, we just cut to the end of the chase. I love the PPP and all that, but let's not pretend what it is.
Curious, we're talking federal policy, your take on the presidential debate earlier this week, Tacky.
Well, I never seen two old guys have a food fight before. I mean, all we need to do is put a tray of food in front of them and we'll see what happens. no surprise. I mean, I am among all of us that says the worst presidential debate that I've ever seen. And I don't think I'm that old, but I watch a lot of presidential debates myself, as well as governor debates and local debates and things on QATV, your debates, but never seen anything like this in terms of its implementation. People have asked me my thoughts on it. I fully expected the debate to go poorly in terms of presentation. I thought that Joe Biden had definitely needed to demonstrate that he couldn't be bullied, much like people that saw the Hillary Trump debates 4 years ago. The belligerence was there again, and the president cranked it up a new notch in the first 10 minutes. And it was imperative that, you know, the Vice President Biden needed to demonstrate that he could not be pushed around. For better or for worse, there's very few ways you could stay high ground that long under a relatively belligerent situation. And, you know, frankly, he told him to shut up, which was the part that caught everyone like gasping. But what are you going to say? I mean, you know, there's a point after like 10 minutes, someone won't let you talk, you're going to look weak.
Yeah, do you think the moderator should have the power to turn the microphone off? That's what they're talking about for the next two debates.
Well, last time I checked, you can mute me on Zoom, so why not? I mean, there needs to be greater control. There is no respect for the moderators. This is not a 10-person debate like you've seen in primaries where it's extremely difficult to control 10 people. I mean, Democratic primary debates were shameful as well because it was just a free-for-all. 4 years ago, the Republican primary debates were also awful. You had 21 people on stage just free-falling on each other like a schoolyard. But now this is one-on-one, and moderators should have greater control to ensure that the American public can actually hear the candidate answer or not answer the question presented, as opposed to being distracted by constantly talking over each other or interrupting each other. You know, we are unable to judge whether the question was actually responded to. We're overly focused on the presentation and not the substance.
Yeah.
So whether, you know, President Trump will agree to go to another debate with changes. Vice President Biden, I'm jumping ahead of myself. Vice President Biden has indicated he will adhere to the debate rule changes. And it shows respect for the fact that candidates, including myself, don't run debates. It is third parties that do that, and we abide to the rules of the third party.
I think a lot of people were interested to learn that there actually is a debate commission, a presidential debate commission. I was not aware of that myself, an actual organization that oversees this and lays the ground rules down.
Yeah, and that's kind of surprising for folks, even though we've been doing presidential debate commissions for longer than I've been alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a formal organization to provide a third party, non-political party run debates. And it's high quality journalists that generally run these debates. I mean, people have different opinions about news channels and journalists and how they report. But, you know, they're the ones who are well educated. And, you know, Chris Wallace, at the debate, is a very well educated reporter. Before he goes in, he knows the answer before he even start the question.
Right.
So, you know, and he also did something that you don't see often. He actually asked very specific, narrow questions. He didn't go and do the free-for-all. Well, you know, what do you think about healthcare as a whole? No, he went after very specific targets. The problem is that they got lost in the conversation because they started talking over each other and the name calling and things like that, which lost the ability to do that. He was not looking for, you know, these big, broad ideas. He wanted you to answer a very narrow, specific question. Or maybe you try to dodge the question completely. Don't answer it. But that isn't the point. He was clearly lost in the public to not have the opportunity to hear an answer towards a very specific targeted question.
Mm-hmm.
So the big losers is us in the audience.
Yeah. We talk a little bit about the voting process coming up and how confident that you feel here in Massachusetts or especially here in Quincy that mail-in voting will be successful.
I think it was very successful already. The highest volume of primary turnout means a lot of unenrolled non-party affiliated voters took a ballot and voted in this past Democratic primary. Generally, you don't see a lot of people vote in primaries because they don't feel like they're part of a political party in the process. But I mean, making it easier for folks to get a ballot has actually encouraged more people to participate. I expect a record turnout this fall We already see the lines in other states during early voting. People scared that they won't get their ballot in on time because of mail-in voting. I don't have that fear in Massachusetts. Obviously, if you are concerned, you got a mail-in ballot, very much encourage you to mail it like right away at the beginning of October, because they'll be coming out next week. Or just drop it off at City Hall in the drop box. I know the City Council is talking about other locations for secure drop boxes. I mean, you know, if you got a box and you bolt it into the ground and you have a lock system, and now the mail post office uses those slots, not the old pull downs, you know, that adds an extra layer of security or whatever goes in that box. So I know the council is debating about whether or not to expand the number of drop boxes. I think it's fine. I do think it's additional cost to the city if they're willing to pay for it. I don't know how quickly they can get secure drop boxes and secure them to the ground. I don't know how quickly they can do that, or if they use city-owned properties for people to accept ballots, but I'm a little more hesitant on that if it's not a, you know, bolted down, secure, waiting for you to put it in. The only election official or police officer observing can acquire those ballots.
Yeah.
But I still, you know, it's a small city. Quincy is not that big. People can walk from North Quincy to City Hall if they wanted to. I mean, nowadays that seems to be my only exercise. Yes. By doing this, not everybody can, you know, get to City Hall easily. I know the parking situation is bad. I hear from everybody about it. So I'm aware of that issue too. But overall, I think it's secure. And, you know, with unlike the primary, you know, ballots can be counted 10 days after the 10 days after election day, if it's postmarked election day, as tradition and law is required, because of overseas ballots to expatriates as well as military personnel.
Right.
So people wondering how could we do that in the primary, it's because of absentee ballots or the mail-in ballots, because if there's a delay as a result of a recount, there's a 10-day process associated with the recount process, which would delay releasing ballots for certain places if that recount process wasn't completed. So,
thank you. Muted.
Sorry.
There you are.
I'm on the cell phone, so I just got muted as something came in.
Oh, okay.
Unless we move the primary early August, we can provide that 10-day window for postmark day of primary day, and it'll count those afterwards because we need enough space associated with getting more ballots out on time for overseas individuals, particularly the military.
Yep.
So we could definitely push it up if we continue to be in a COVID situation 2 years from now and continue to be in an emergency power situation to do mail-in ballots that way. But as we talked about before, mail-in ballots are not allowed in the Constitution. Absentee ballots are allowed by the Constitution under specific conditions. Because COVID-19, we consider the physical physical impediment where you get to vote is how we're allowing mail-in ballots today, which is basically just expanded absentee ballots.
Yeah. We talk a little bit about a local issue that's cropped up this week, Tacky, is the compressor station down in North Weymouth and, you know, the emergency shutdowns that have occurred, and now the federal government stepping in and closing it down for the time being, at least. What do you think about that?
I'm not sure what's going on beyond what I read in the news. I've not talked to anybody that's directly associated with the compressor station. Venting was something that I think everybody knew was going to happen at some point. It's actually part of the system, but generally don't vent natural gas directly into the air. It's, you know, stuff that's already been burned off. And it appears to be a mechanical issue. At this stage, they have personnel on in the opening process. It just isn't one of those things like a machine where you just kind of walk in, flip the switch, and leave the door and turn off the lights and just walk away. You know, this is still very early on if it's implementation in a very old gas system. Our gas system's so old. People don't realize how old our gas system really is. So I don't actually know the details behind that. You know, obviously, the early stages of this man is, you know, system trying to test the systems out to see if they make sure they work properly before sending it to full automation. So I wish I had more information, but I really don't know beyond that. Obviously, shutting it down is a smart move as part of its opening to see if it's functioning correctly. Clearly, there is some functionality issues. And the good thing, of course, is they caught it early on as opposed to being around for like 6 years and then something bad happens. So hopefully these things can be rectified and we'll see how it goes. But I have no personal knowledge about what's going to happen, what's happening over there.
Yeah, no, it's not in your district. I know it's in the North Weymouth areas, but it does affect the whole Four River Basin, certainly. So as did the power plant there before that, actually.
But that's correct. People, I think, sometimes forget we had actually a full-blown power plant sitting in the Fall River. I don't even remember that because we used to go snow fishing there in the winter. Fish like the warm weather around power plants because of the warm water it puts out. So
that's right. There's another change in the census, Jackie, since last we talked.
Yes, every time I give information, it seems like by next week, it sounds like I didn't know what I was talking about. It appears to be a recurring pattern in my life, talking to you every Friday. The census deadline is now October 5th. The federal judge tried to push the census deadline back to October 31st. The census is appealing that decision by a federal judge. So as a result, they decided to do October 5th to give everyone essentially one more week. Or actually less than one more week, because September 30th was the deadline, which was Wednesday, right? Today's mm-hmm. October 2nd. So we're going to get basically another weekend. Again, the self-reporting, very strong for nationally. Massachusetts nationally was 66.6%. 666 nationally, could figure that one out. Massachusetts, 69% reporting. Quincy was 69% reporting, Weymouth 74.6, Braintree 79.3, Randolph 70.9, Milton 82.4, and Holbrook 75.4. So self-reporting, meaning there was no one calling you, nobody coming to your door. Very strong results in my mind, all exceeding 2010 numbers. So thank you very much for participating. Nationally, people have been counted by actually physically going to the doors or phone banked. Was at 98.96%. Massachusetts was 99.4%. Norfolk County was the best turnout at 75.2%. In terms of sub-reporting, Quincy was 29 out of 54 communities that are cities on the reporting system. So we're not as good as other cities, but we're also bigger than most of them too. That also being said, certain states like Louisiana is grossly undercounted. And even following the news, given the record number of tropical storms and hurricanes passing through the Gulf Coast, where it seems like every week is a hurricane, some equivalent storm of high winds and rain, that obviously has impeded census taking in the Gulf Coast. So places like Louisiana has extremely low numbers. And the census should try to accommodate states that have had severe impediments beyond COVID to try to get those numbers counted. I do know they have to be completely counted and tabulated by the end of this year by Constitution. But, I mean, the census could allow an extended deadline for certain states that basically through no fault of their own, has had some barriers associated to reporting. So we'll see what happens on Monday. Maybe in our next conversation, the date moves again. I am feeling awful silly telling people dates that don't work.
Well, it just goes to show you don't have a crystal ball, so we can only work with the information we have at the time.
Absolutely. But thank you very much for your participation. You still have a little more time left for 2020 census.gov. So if you're watching this over the weekend or on the 5th itself, but please do log on and count everybody in your household.
Oh, anything else we should touch on today, Tacky?
Well, I mean, the news broke today on the President and First Lady getting COVID-19.
Yes.
Reminded everybody, nobody's immune to this disease. It can infiltrate everywhere. Mild symptoms may not seem serious, but you're not quite sure, and you should keep away from people who are not feeling well. In their case, it sounds like, because I only heard about it this morning, this news broke this morning, and I just saw Mark Meadows on TV right before I came on to talk to you. It sounds like right now the symptoms are mild, and it seems that the Hicks, who the aide who had COVID-19 and spreading it, had very mild symptoms as part of the spread process. So that's even scarier because the person was symptomatic at some level and didn't get tested immediately or isolated from the rest of the White House staff and the president and first lady. So, I fully expect that, security protocol goes into effect where the vice president's definitely going to be isolated from the White House in case the worst case scenario happens, whether the president's heavily incapacitated or, God forbid, passes. And if people don't know, the change of session moves to the Speaker of the House. should the vice president become incapacitated or dies. So I suspect the full security protocol is going to be put in effect to protect the other change of session from presidency. And, you know, we talked earlier about the debate commission, president debate commission, about changes to format. And if the president isn't doing well, there is the chance that he may not debate the second two debates. And I'm going to expect the presidential debate, vice presidential debate coming up is going to be heavily secured regarding contact and testing and social distancing and sanitations. I think it'll be even higher level moving to those debates. And I'm probably going to have zero attendance already. I mean, people aren't physically in the audience, but I think they're going to even probably clear the room at that point. I mean, I would. Nobody comes in, period. And I would, you know, probably isolate their own staffers and family from each other in the presidential debate locations. So, you know, this should be a wake-up call to everybody at home that, you know, if 7 million people getting it isn't sufficient for you to believe that this is a problem, and the 210 plus and counting everyday deaths. Well, in Massachusetts, I mean, we've crossed the 700 barrier. We're looking at spike number 2 if these numbers don't stabilize and go down. And hospitalization rates have gone up again this month. And it's only early October. And I've rarely seen the death count drop below double digits during this whole time period, sadly.
Yeah. Do you know the field hospitals that were set up, are those still ready to go in the event they're needed?
I've been informed that the convention center, for example, since there are no conventions,
right,
which again, we can talk about more about economic impact about the lack of conventions, the materials, supplies, and everything that had that field hospital can be just pulled out of storage that's still stored at the convention center in a moment's notice by National Guard and can probably set it up inside half a day. Okay. Since they already know how to do it, they can do it the same way. Same thing over at DCU. Mm-hmm. It's ready to go. National Guard goes in, set it up, probably can be ready in less than half a day. Winter time is going to be tough because, you know, we could do outdoor field hospitals like at Gillette Stadium.
Right.
So I don't think, like, shouldn't say that. Every time I say don't think, I'm wrong. Feels like these days. I'm hoping, I think is a better word, that the second spike is a very mild spike. There will be an increase for a time period of COVID cases, and then it will level off, and then we just have to just ride the level off, you know, flatten the curve until there's a decline. You know, it'll be like, you know, little bumps, you know, relatively flat little bumps, as opposed to just up and down spiking. That's the hope. And God forbid we actually have to implement those field hospitals. I'm fairly comfortable that we could do that. And I'm sure, you know, FEMA and the governor's task force looking at alternative locations that are indoors. For example, if you're up in a low area, you know, you have the available universities as well as their convention center, the Sangha Center. If in the Southeast Coast, you know, you obviously have the places like UMass Dartmouth and others. And given hotels are right now struggling, and I'm hoping that the stimulus program in the federal level includes more COVID money, not just a bailout for the states and other industries. You know, we can always stop paying hotels like we did before to house COVID positive patients that have very, very, very mild symptoms.
Let's hope, like you say, all that is precautionary and not necessary. That's for sure.
Yes, and it costs money. And that's why the federal stimulus packages are still very important, because we have to come up to pay for readiness. And I talked a little about this before, but you know, the big three industries, healthcare, education, and tourism, all pretty much dysfunctional in our economy, which is why we used to have the highest unemployment rate in the country. But you know, why I say healthcare? Because they're like, oh, you know, they got these COVID patients getting paid for it. Yeah, but it isn't the same reimbursement rate they get for optional patients in terms of optional surgeries, non-essential emergency procedures to be done, which eventually has to be addressed, but you don't have to do it today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the healthcare system has a lot of other aspects to it that is largely insurance-driven reimbursement. So the healthcare industry is still struggling on making its footing as they maintain COVID readiness, which is not going to be covered by insurance. The government needs to put out the money to pay for those COVID readiness. So those ICU rooms, you know, still needs to be COVID ready.
Yep. Ways to reach out to you, Techie?
Well, again, you can call the office at 617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. We've been definitely checking up voicemails, and people have been calling us, so very thankful for doing that. Tacky.chan, TACKEY.CHAN, at mahouse.gov, Tacky.chan, CHAN, at mahouse.gov. Sometimes people spell either my first name or my last name wrong, so it is an A, and there is an E in my first name, an A in the last name. But, you know, again, I get a whole lot of emails about everything, you know, which is a challenge to keep up. So phone call is generally the best, and we'll get back to you as quick as possible. We do prioritize based on need. So given the severity of the situation, we'll get back to you very quickly.
All right. Good to talk to you as always. Have a wonderful week.
Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Stay warm or stay cool, depending on which way the weather goes.
Everything these days, that's true. All right. Thanks again, Tacky.
Take care, Joe.